From Ground Zero Radio, this is Democracy Now in Exile.
For decades since the Second World War, we've been telling people, lecturing third world countries, China, Africa, the Arabs, the Middle East, on human rights, on the necessity to obey the Geneva Conventions, reminding them of the Nuremberg Trials. Yet when we wage our war of civilization, when our glittering towers are hit, we tear up all these conventions, we turn our backs on them, we say no investigations into war crimes, and there is hypocrisy writ large.
Renowned British journalist Robert Fisk is beaten by a crowd of angry Afghans, and he blames the West. We'll hear his story. Then a West Virginia high school student is suspended for wearing a T-shirt that says, "When I saw the dead and dying Afghani children on TV, I felt a newly recovered sense of national security. God bless America." She's suing the school. All that and more coming up. Welcome to the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Anti-Taliban forces, aided by fierce U.S. bombing, are claiming to have driven out al-Qaeda fighters and their families from a network of caves in the Tora Bora region in eastern Afghanistan, forcing them to retreat to nearby mountaintops where some appeared to be trying to arrange a surrender. It's not clear if all of the al-Qaeda soldiers have been forced out of the caves, and there was no indication Osama bin Laden is among those who fled. Afghan troops said dozens of heavily armed U.S. soldiers thought to be from special forces units made lightning raids against key al-Qaeda positions overnight as part of the assault by hundreds of Mujahideen fighters. They were aided by continued intense U.S. bombardment, which yesterday included the use of 15,000-pound fuel-air incendiary bombs, euphemistically called daisy cutters. Across the Afghan border in neighboring Pakistan, Pakistani soldiers have been deployed on mountains south of Tora Bora to stop al-Qaeda fighters from crossing over. The New York Times is reporting scores of Taliban prisoners died after surrendering to Northern Alliance forces asphyxiated in the shipping containers they were packed in while being transported to prison. Witnesses say the deaths occurred as the prisoners were brought from the town of Kunduz to the prison in the town of Shibargan, a journey that took 2 or 3 days. Prisoners describe gruesome scenes in which hundreds of men desperately sought to breathe in the virtually airtight containers. One youth said through the bars of his prison wing that at least 100 had suffocated in his container alone. "No oxygen, no oxygen," he said urgently in English. The British government will head an international force of 4,000 troops in the next 2 weeks that'll deploy in Afghanistan for a 3-month period. At least 1,000 German troops are also expected to participate. The troops will stay during the launch of the interim government before handing over to a larger multinational effort led by Turkey. Northern Alliance and other forces are worried about the British taking the lead in such a deployment, given their role in military operations with the U.S. that have killed thousands of Afghan civilians. But British Prime Minister Tony Blair said there was no contradiction in allowing British forces that previously were attacking Afghanistan to be involved in non-offensive capabilities. The White House last night said it would release a video of Osama bin Laden in the next 48 hours, in which he allegedly says the destruction of the World Trade Center towers was far greater than he'd expected. The video also allegedly shows bin Laden appearing amused that some of the hijackers involved in the September 11th attacks were not aware they were going to die. U.S. officials say the video represents a smoking gun, conclusively proving bin Laden's prior knowledge of the suicide attacks. The tape was found in Jalalabad 11 days ago in a private home. The officials are accused. That's some of the news at that point. After years of denying any link between illness and service in the Persian Gulf War, military officials said yesterday that veterans of the conflict were nearly twice as likely to suffer from Lou Gehrig's disease as other soldiers. So far, some 40 veterans have been diagnosed with the disease, which causes severe muscle wasting and is typically fatal in 2 to 5 years. The Department of Veterans Affairs said it would immediately offer disability and survivor benefits to veterans with the disease who served in the Persian Gulf War during the conflict a decade ago. And the Financial Times is reporting that U.S. military advisors visited Somalia on Sunday for talks with opposition clan leaders to identify potential targets for U.S. military strikes. Israeli helicopters killed 2 children, including a 3-year-old boy, when they fired missiles at cars in a crowded street in the West Bank city of Hebron yesterday in a failed attempt to assassinate a suspected member of Islamic Jihad. 7 other people were injured. The attack was immediately cited by Palestinian officials as further evidence that Sharon was heightening the conflict to consolidate Israel's occupation of the West Bank and Gaza and foreclose any possibility of meaningful negotiations. The Supreme Court agreed yesterday to decide whether former Secretary of State Warren Christopher and former President Bill Clinton could be sued by human rights lawyer Jennifer Harbury for deliberately misleading her about the fate of her Guatemalan husband. The officials are accused of lying about what the U.S. knew about the 1994 kidnapping, torture, and execution of Jennifer Harbury's husband, Efraim Bamaka Velasquez, by a Guatemalan officer on the payroll of the CIA.
I live my life beside an ocean, and every day I drown emotion with tide. No one's ever asked me why, guess I'm still
Save the day, Alana Davis here on the War and Peace Report, broadcasting just blocks from the first Ground Zero. Afghanistan is the second. I'm Amy Goodman. Renowned British journalist Robert Fisk was severely beaten by a crowd of people in an Afghan village just 2 days ago, barely escaped with his life. He wrote this just after the incident. Some of the Afghans in the little village had been there for years. Others had arrived desperate and angry and mourning their slaughtered loved ones over the past 2 weeks. What happened to us was symbolic of the hatred and fury and hypocrisy of this filthy war. A growing band of destitute Afghan men, young and old, who saw foreigners, enemies in their midst and tried to destroy at least one of them. Many of these Afghans, so we were to learn, Robert Fisk writes, were outraged by what they had seen on television of the Mazar-e Sharif massacres, of the prisoners killed with their hands tied behind their backs. A villager later told one of our drivers that they'd seen the videotape of CIA officers Mike and Dave threatening death to a kneeling prisoner at Mazar. They were uneducated. I doubt if many could read, but you don't have to have a schooling to respond to the death of loved ones under B-52's bombs. At one point, a screaming teenager had turned to my driver and asked in all sincerity, "Is that Mr. Bush?" Robert Fisk went on in his independent piece, "I thought I should write about what happened to us in this fearful, silly, bloody, tiny incident. I feared other versions would produce a different narrative of how a British journalist was beaten up by a mob of Afghan refugees. We were able to reach him on the telephone yesterday to tell his story." I began by just asking Robert Fisk how he was feeling.
Mother of all headaches, as Saddam Hussein might say, but no, I'm feeling better. Obviously, at the time when you see yourself covered in blood, it's a very disturbing experience. Also, because you realise that here were people who wanted to hurt you and indeed wanted to kill you. You know, it does bring you face to face with the reality of the way people feel when they feel humiliated and oppressed, I suppose, is the old socialist word, and the way in which when they feel that their families are being killed, you can see the brute force of a whole people who feel that they're being destroyed by the West, if you like. And obviously, I was, so to speak, the symbol of the West in this incident, and my colleague Justin, to some extent, though lucky enough to get on the bus, and he tried to pull me onto it, a bus where the driver was trying to rescue us. But I think, as you know, I wrote in my article in the Independent of London this morning, that if I had been them, if I had been encouraged to fight the Russians with weapons and money from the West, and then ignored, and then endured civil war, and then asked to fight the Taliban, and then had my home bombed by the Americans, and then lost members of my family, I mean, I would try to beat up any Westerner I came across. I'd try to attack Robert Fisk too. So, you know, it is impossible for me to feel anger against the people who did this. I mean, they shouldn't have done it, but that's not an argument that works in the kind of brutal landscape that we have helped to create out here. So my overall feeling is that, you know, who can possibly blame them for striking back against the terrible things that happened to them?
Robert, can you tell us exactly what happened and when it happened?
Yes, it was Saturday afternoon. I was traveling from the border town of Quetta in Pakistan down towards the frontier post at Chaman, towards a mountain chain that runs parallel with Afghanistan. And at a village called Kila Abdullah, which by great misfortune to us houses many thousands of Afghan refugees, the boiler started to boil over in the car, the radiator, and steam started to come out of the radiator, and the car stopped in the middle of the road, in the middle of this crowded village, full, of course, of angry people. Angry, as we learned later, not only because they'd lost many relatives in the Kandahar, which is only about 90, 80 miles away as the crow flies from the village, but also because they'd been outraged by the film of the prisoners who'd in Mazar-e Sharif, most of whom were Pashtuns, as the refugees were in this village. They had seen also the videotape, so we were told later, of the CIA agents, Dave and Mike, interviewing, or rather interrogating, the Muslim man kneeling on the floor with his hands tied behind his back. So obviously when two Westerners, Justin Hugler and myself, suddenly turned up with a broken car in the middle of the village, we became... Well, first of all, actually, we became friends. We went around, people came around the car, we said, Salaam alaikum, peace be upon you, alaikum salam, and we shook hands, and people gave us a sort of two-handed handshake. And everything was all right for about a minute. The driver went off to get a new, you know, a fresh car, a taxi. The translator stood next to us. And then we decided there was too big a crowd. A lot of the men were bearded. They were not smiling anymore. We moved towards the center of the road, very crowded road, because, you see, we blocked the road when the car broke down, so a lot of people, a lot of traffic. And let's just move out of here into the center of the road, get away from the crowd, but the crowd followed us. And as we walked, a little boy sort of snapped his finger against my wrist rather hard. I hoped that it was just, you know, a joke. Then a pebble spun over my shoulder and hit Justin on the shoulder. And we looked at each other, Justin's eyes full of concern, and we realized something was going wrong there. We then found ourselves being jostled, pushed, punched, not very much, but a little bit, and we suddenly saw a bus driver beckoning us to get on his bus. It was heading back to Quetta. Justin made it onto the bus. I put the first step up. Boys and young men grabbed the blue satchel that was around my shoulder, the satchel in which I carry my passport, credit cards, papers, etc., and tried to pull me back. Justin reached out his hand, and I grasped it. But he tried to pull me on. The crowd were pulling me back, and in the end, they did go of his hand. And they were shouting. I don't know what they were shouting. I don't speak Pashto. I can speak Arabic. And then they started really hit me, first of all on the back, then the shoulders, and then I had fists on the face, and then stones sort of bouncing off my shoulders and bouncing off my head, and then two men came up and started to bash me on the face and the head with stones, and very quickly, as it was running down my face, a man came up and smashed my glasses into my face. There was blood in my eyes. I couldn't see. I was short-sighted, and then I couldn't see at all. I felt my shirt going wet with blood. My pullover was drenched in it. It began splashing on my shoes and trousers. And I was obviously in a difficult situation because although there were 60 at the beginning, I thought there were around 100 people by the time I was bleeding. You know, it was like a bloody horse being slaughtered. It sort of attracted people in an animal-like way, which I don't like to think about. And I was then on my own. Justin and I had lost our grip of each other, and I remembered Lebanese always said, if you're in danger, whatever you do, don't do nothing. So the next man, well, actually, he'd already hit me once. There was a man with a stone who wanted to bash it into my face again. So I hit him with my fist, and I just saw out of the corner of my eye, he spat his tooth out. In fact, on my right wrist now, I've got a big scar from the tooth which I knocked out. And then I went for three other people. I missed one and hit two others and started running. And just for a moment, the crowd held back because, you know, the dying creature, so to speak, had suddenly come alive again, and that was obviously what I intended. And then I ran down the road, and at one point a figure came out. I was standing in the road. The glasses had gone. They'd ripped off my spare pair. I'd actually, unfortunately, also I later discovered, taken my contacts book away with 25 years of names and telephone numbers around the Middle East that had dropped out of my bag when they were trying to seize it. And I was trying desperately with my fingers to push the blood out of my eyes. And I saw this figure come that took me very gently by the right arm, man in robe with a kind of turban and a beard. I didn't really see his face. I didn't concentrate. I kept saying, help me, salam alaikum, peace be upon you. And I think he was some kind of religious person, a cleric, a mullah, perhaps a Muslim, of course, in the village. And as he led me away, the crowd sort of paused, and they sent stones after me, but skittering along the road, not at me, in case they hit the man. So he must have been important in the village. And he put me on board a little police truck we found, and they were too terrified to move. And I was on the truck. I climbed up towards the back of the cab with a little window, and I kept banging on it, saying, help me, help me. And I remember my blood was sort of streaming down the window behind them. And they drove about 15 meters forward. Then the religious man came back and obviously told them to help me more. And they then drove about 300 meters. And there, like a miracle, incredibly, was a Red Cross, Red Crescent convoy. And two Bangladeshi Muslim doctors immediately took me out of the back of the police vehicle and started to pour water over my wounds because my hands were just crimson. I mean, it looked like a scene from, you know, Christians to the Lions in the Colosseum. And they quickly put a bandage around my head, and they started, you know, putting wads of bandages on all the wounds I had and told me to lie on the floor of the ambulance and threw a blanket over me so that when the first people arrived, which they quickly did, didn't recognize me. And then they got me out, and Justin, my colleague, very fortunately, he got out of the bus. The people there didn't help us, but they didn't hurt him. And he eventually found himself close to his car, and in his car, protected by a very stout man belonging to an organization called the Baluchistan Levies, obviously originally raised under the British Mandate. And he was there with a rifle and just threatened back the crowd to keep away from Justin. And in due course, in fact, we were reunited further down the road when I was still with the Red Cross convoy. So we then came back, very much tail between our legs, of course, to Quetta, where we were able to have our wounds dressed again and washed, and where two, well, not ours, I had wounds, Justin was just pushed around a bit, and two doctors came and considerably painfully managed to sort of clip off bits of my hair, which were caked with blood, and put bandages on me.
Robert Fisk describing what happened to him just how many days ago was it?
It was a day and a half ago. It feels like a week now, but it was a day and a half ago.
And so how did you ultimately end up where you are right now?
Well, I'm still where I got back to in Quetta. I'm in my hotel room. I obviously spent the next day sleeping somewhat fitfully because immediately to turn around in bed, the crowd of people were kicking me as well, so I've got bruises all over my back and my shoulder and my legs and my sides. So even to turn around in bed is actually quite painful, but you quickly get your appetite back if you're going to be all right. And I must say I refuse a tetanus injection, refuse stitches, because I somehow hate those things. But I'll have a couple of scars on my face, but otherwise the doctors, the Pakistani doctors who came here, said I would be all right. So I will. So I'm carrying on reporting as best I can.
So do you plan to leave, Robert?
Not at the moment. I think our job is to go on reporting. I was actually planning to go on holiday several days ago, and it was only when Kandahar fell that I decided to stay on. So I'm perfectly entitled if I want to leave at this minute, but I don't intend to, in fact.
Robert Fisk speaking to us from Pakistan. He was beaten up in Afghanistan just having come out. It was the only Western reporter in Kandahar province. You are listening to the War and Peace Report. When we come back, we're going to hear about some of the other stories he has reported on while in Afghanistan. Stay with us.
The R is in the house, too much tension. Make sure the system's loud when I mention. Crazy is fearsome. You wanna hear some sounds that not only pounds but plays your eardrum. I sit back and observe the whole scenery. Then nonchalantly tell you what it mean to me. Strictly business, I'm quickly in this mood. And I don't care if the whole crowd's a witness. I'ma tear you apart, but I'ma spare you a heart. Programming to the speed of the rhyme, prepare to start. Rhythms out of the radius, the same as the craziest. Musical madness, MC, I'm amazing. Now an emergency, open heart surgery. Open your mind, you will find every word to be. Furier than ever, I remain the future. Battles tempting, whatever suits you. From word to sentence, there's no resemblance. You're thinking rough for the self of the consequences. I'm never dying, terrifying results. I wake up with hundreds of thousands of false mics to mouth resuscitation. Rhythm with radiation, overcame needs a pain and might save him. If not, Eric B's the judge, the crowd's a jury. How do I plead to homicide? Lyrics of fury.
Lyrics of fury. Eric B. and Rakim here on the War and Peace Report. The exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. As we continue with Robert Fisk in Pakistan, he had just come from Afghanistan when a group of Afghan men and boys beat him up. He's just described that story. We had a little trouble on the line to Pakistan, but he continued with discussing his reporting in Afghanistan.
Robert Fisk, you were the only Western journalist in Taliban-held Kandahar before it has, as they say, fallen. Can you describe what it was like?
No. Well, first of all, let me explain. I was in Kandahar province. No Western newspaper man has yet got to Kandahar city. I'm sure lots would like to, including me, but we haven't. What happened with me was that the Taliban, after much many requests by myself and attempts to contact them through third parties, agreed that I could cross into their territory at Spin Boldak, the border village which they held opposite Chaman in Pakistan, and that they would then take me to Kandahar City. And I actually had a visa with "For Kandahar City Only" written on it by the Taliban authorities. When I got the other side of the border, I was met by Taliban people who understood and knew of my intended visit to the city, which is about 60 miles away. They were obviously very nervous, quite upset, didn't really want to go there. My first reaction was that they were, you know, breaking their word, that this was a contract, that they'd merely issued the invitation to pretend that they'd take me and then turn me around. I met some of the local Taliban commanders, one of whom was racing for the border, claiming he had medical problems. He's never come back. So obviously the Taliban were already in a series of in a state of considerable retreat. However, I did set off with some armed Taliban men towards Kandahar City. We got maybe 7, maybe 12 miles down the road, short of a town called Takhtapol. And in front of us, there were clouds of smoke, F-18 American aircraft flying so low I could see the markings on the aircraft. Very high up, a lot of contrails of the B-52 bomber streams. We carried on down the road. Then we met a trail of refugees, a woman coming down saying she'd lost her children in Kandahar, 3 children, 2 girls and a boy in American air raid. Then a man who said an American aircraft had just destroyed his house behind him in Takhtapol. He described an aircraft which he said was spitting smoke and soaking the ground with fire, which is a pretty good description for a probably illiterate man of the so-called Spectre Bumblebee American C-130 converted aircraft. There was a lot of rumbling of bombs, and the Taliban just stopped the car. And we must have been 12 miles down the road. And they just said, "We're not going on." And I said, the foolish journalist, I said, "Well, come on, you know, I've been under American bombs in Kosovo and Serbia and American-made bombs dropped by the Israelis in Lebanon." And they said, "No, we're not going." One of them said to me, he's the father of 5, and he looked about 60, but he was only about 30. He said to me, "If we can't protect ourselves, how can we protect you?" And then they turned around. I suppose I was regretful, but with that normal journalistic huge sigh of relief when you're going into danger on a story, thank God we didn't carry on in the story I wanted. I then found myself among other refugees. One man was a mullah with a black turban who slumped down at my feet and said, "My brother's just escaped from the fighting down the road." This was the day we later discovered, or I later discovered, this was the same day upon which a Northern Alliance leader was to say that they executed 160 Taliban prisoners in the town of Takhtapol, the town we were heading for, in the presence of U.S. servicemen who the man said had tried to stop the execution. So obviously, whether this story itself is true or not, or even partly true, pretty terrible things were happening down the road. And in retrospect, I'm sure it was a good thing that we turned back.
We're talking to Robert Fisk, who's just come out of Afghanistan, badly beaten himself. He's in Quetta, Pakistan right now. And the only Western journalist in Kandahar province. We just broke a story with the University of New Hampshire professor who has spent every day since October 7th, about 14 hours a day, trying to tabulate the trying to count the casualties in Afghanistan. And he's arrived at an extremely conservative estimate, he said, of over 3,700. He believes it's actually more like 5,000. What do you think of this? He's comparing reports from all over the world and has just been adding them each day.
Yeah, I have not had the opportunity to spend 14 hours a day on a computer. The real thing, as you know, is that when you're in a war, you know what's going on about 4 feet either side of you, and that's quite enough. But obviously, I've done a few calculations on, you know, the proverbial backs of envelopes. Given the evidence that I've personally, direct evidence, picked up, talking to the families of children who died, you know, parents who said 5 children here, 4 children there, an aunt, an uncle, etc., if I alone, in my own wanderings, have come across so many dozens of dead, there must be dead into the thousands. Remember, in some villages around the areas around Jalalabad, where U.S. bombers are plastering the hillsides, there are 60, 70 people in the village dead, 40 graves here, 50 graves there. I would figure, I mean, just out of the blue, the figure of 3,700 kind of makes sense to me in the sense that that doesn't seem at all surprising. Certainly, there have been an awful lot of casualties around Kandahar in the past 2 weeks, and they're continuing on. Many cases where people have arrived at the border of Chaman and Spinbolak and said, we've just seen 15 people killed in their cars when they're on the roads. You realize that many of the aircraft, just as in Kosovo, the U.S. aircraft are flying so high that you can't distinguish between a tractor or a car or a jeep or a tank. And if the overall figure was 5,000, I wouldn't be at all surprised. Though they may be of a different color skin and in many cases tragically uneducated, and who speak no language other than Pashto, they are equally as innocent and good and decent people as all those who were so cruelly murdered in the World Trade Center. But strangely enough, merely by saying we didn't mean to kill them, the American government appears to wish to avoid the opprobrium, which we correctly attach to bin Laden, assuming he's responsible, the Taliban, the people who were flying those aircraft.
Robert Fisk, we just got report of this videotape of Osama bin Laden that the U.S. government says that they have, deciding whether to release it, where he says he, you know, that he is responding to the World Trade Center attacks, and he says, you know, there's another one about to happen on that day. That indicates that he knew exactly what was going on. Do you know anything about this?
I'll wait to see the videotape before I believe anything else. You know, we were told, first of all, that the CIA agents were interrogating people in the prison at Mazar-i-Sharif and everything was perfectly normal. And then quite recently, we actually saw a videotape, which was not offered to us, of course, by the U.S. government and Vice President Cheney, in which quite clearly the prisoner was kneeling on the ground with his hands behind the back, his back, and in some cases apparently being threatened with death. Well, we've seen that videotape, and that tells us a lot, I think. One would like very much to see the videotape of bin Laden, but until I've seen it, I think, you know, one has to reserve judgment as a journalist. I've many times in the Middle East been told about the most sensational videotapes, which have never seen the light of day, or which, if we have seen them, do not actually stand up to questioning and don't marry up with the original, you know, description. So it maybe it's true, but I'll believe it when I see it, and that doesn't mean I don't believe it, merely that we've got to see the evidence before we make our judgment.
You have a piece titled, We Are the War Criminals Now. Explain.
Well, there's no doubt that terrible deeds were perpetrated at Mazar-i-Sharif. There is photographic evidence of dead prisoners, murdered prisoners with their hands tied behind their backs. There is clear evidence of Northern Alliance militiamen wandering out, tearing out the gold teeth from prisoners' mouths, dead prisoners, of course. We know there was some pretty grotesque interrogations. I don't know if violence was used. We know that once the uprising in the prison, we don't know why the uprising took place, whether it was a plot by the Taliban prisoners to take over the prison, or whether they became convinced that they were going to be executed and therefore it was better to die. We know that American aircraft repeatedly bombed the prison. I've never heard of a prison being bombed by jet aircraft repeatedly before because it was a revolt. We know that U.S. special forces were involved. We know, sadly for the United Kingdom, that British SAS men were involved. Clearly, the massacre, the killing of so many prisoners, the use of such heavy armaments against them, even if they had weapons, the discovery that prisoners were dead with their hands tied behind their backs, the fact that our allies in the Northern Alliance could commit and perpetrate the most cruel acts against the dead bodies, like tearing out gold teeth, I think there's no doubt that, we're speaking about war crimes. And when Amnesty calls for an inquiry, when Mary Robinson calls for an inquiry, there should be, and it's interesting to see that the Americans refuse. First of all, when Amnesty called for the inquiry, Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld said, inquiry? What inquiry? I don't know anything about this. The idea that the Secretary of Defense doesn't know that Amnesty International, the most famous human rights organization in the world, has called for an inquiry into a massacre in which his own forces were involved is simply preposterous. It's incredible. It is not believable. And now we have the British Home Secretary, Jack Straw, saying it really isn't possible and hinting that Afghanistan is a bit more savage than elsewhere, being presumably, you know, brown skin, Muslim, age-old tradition of fighting, the usual line that we really got in many cases about Bosnia before the West really intervened. But when we come down to it, yes, we're talking about war crimes. You've got to remember that at another point in a press conference, Secretary Rumsfeld said that our troops are embedded in their forces. Well, you can't ally yourself to a bunch of mafiosi like the Northern Alliance. And by the way, the Taliban were a bunch of gunmen, murderers and torturers as well. Let's remember that. But you can't ally yourself to one side in a war who are murderous mafiosi, and some of them, in fact, rapists who ran rape campaigns in Kabul between 1992 and 1996. And then when they commit crimes, which they were used to doing, say, oh, well, it's nothing to do with us. We didn't do it. It's a savage part of the world. We couldn't stop it. What could we do? That's not good enough. At the end of the Second World War, for example, when Nazi German officers said that they could not be held responsible for the acts of their militia allies, like, for example, the Croatian Ustashi, who had murdered tens of thousands of Serbs and Jews, the Germans were not allowed to get away with that excuse. They were put on trial. But we, apparently, fighting a war for civilization, fighting a war for good against evil, fighting a war for good against evil, we, apparently, can get away with it even if our allies commit war crimes. We, apparently, can get away with it when our allies commit war crimes. And this is the problem. You know, for decades since the Second World War, we've been telling people, lecturing third world countries, China, Africa, the Arabs, the Middle East, on human rights, on the necessity to obey the Geneva Conventions, reminding them of the Nuremberg trials. Yet when we wage our war of civilization, when our glittering towers are hit, we tear up all these conventions, we turn our backs on them, we say no investigations into war crimes. And there is hypocrisy writ large.
You also write about the Taliban being a creation of the Northern Alliance. Can you explain?
Yes, the Northern Alliance, when they came to power and ousted Najibullah, the last communist ruler following the Soviet occupation and intervention, between 1992 and 1996, the Northern Alliance, the same bunch of people who are now supposed to be our allies, killed up to 50,000 people in Kabul in infighting in a civil war. They fought each other. They destroyed much of Kabul itself. There was, across the land of Afghanistan, butchery, rape, theft, pillage. And the Taliban were a reaction to this. The Taliban grew out of rural clerical roots of young men who said, we can no longer allow seeing our daughters raped, our children taken away, our families murdered, our land taken. And under a very strict religious ethos, much encouraged, in fact, by the Saudi Arabian government, Saudi Arabia and Pakistan as well, they set out to destroy the Northern Alliance and drove them out of much of Afghanistan to the immense relief of most of the people, not only the Pashtuns, but also the Uzbeks and many of the Hazaras. But the Taliban were also extremely self-righteous. They imposed a religious law which was preposterous in its outdated nature. And the net result was that people turned against them and found it was a joyless regime. Well, they still preferred to live in peace, but they wanted to live. And in fact, they found themselves living for religion and nothing else. And no population wants to do that. On top of that, of course, the Taliban, after several years, engaged in their own massacres and atrocities, particularly in northern Afghanistan around the town of Mazar-e-Sharif.
Robert Fisk, speaking to us from Pakistan. He was just badly beaten in Afghanistan. Robert Fisk is a award-winning reporter with the independent newspaper in Britain. He is usually based in Beirut, went to cover the war on Afghanistan. You are listening to the War and Peace Report. For the rest of the program, we're going to talk to young people about what they're doing in this time of war. Hampshire College is the first school in the country to adopt a resolution condemning the so-called war on terrorism. And yesterday, 16 youth and student groups launched a campaign pledging to stand against this war. They launched at the Japanese-American War Memorial in Washington. But first, we're turning to Katie Sierra. She's 15 years old. She's from Charleston, West Virginia. And she went to school wearing a T-shirt with a handwritten anti-war message on it. The shirt said, "When I saw the dead and dying Afghani children on TV, I felt a newly recovered sense of national security. God bless America." She was suspended. She joins us from Charleston, West Virginia. Welcome to the War and Peace Report, Katie.
Thank you.
So did you write this yourself? I mean, you came up with this line?
I did, and my friend Mike also helped me write it.
Mm-hmm.
We wrote it together.
What made you think of it? Why did you wear this T-shirt to school?
I don't really know. I mean, that's just how I felt, and I didn't think it would be a big deal. I mean, I've worn it before, but no one really read it, I guess.
So what happened?
I got cursed out by some boy in my class, and he was sent to the office for, like, disrupting class, and then, like, I think a period later, they called me to the office and suspended me. They didn't, like, I thought they were supposed to, I mean, I don't see a problem wearing the shirt, but even if they do see a problem, they should tell me at least to take it off, which they never did. I mean, they just told me I was suspended. You know, ridiculous, but...
Did they hurt you?
The students?
Yeah.
Yeah, like, 2 weeks after when, like, the newspapers got involved, and my principal, he said that I wanted, like, America to burn and Afghanistan to win and, you know, stuff like that, which wasn't true. And, I mean, he says it's not true now, but he won't, like, talk to the students about it. So they kind of are upset with me, I guess.
And school board members?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they don't like me very much. I went to speak at the school board meeting, and they told me that, you know, like, what the hell is wrong with a kid like that? And, you know, all kinds of things. And I'm in front of, like, 100 parents, and I thought I was going to pass out. But
so what about your teachers?
Well, I have one that kind of supports me, but she can't say much because they've been told not to support me or talk to anyone or anything like that.
Is it true you wrote a manifesto?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
What does the manifesto say?
It pretty much just said, you know, the students at Sissonville, like our group, we wanted to start a club, and we're all pacifists. We don't want to be, like, associated with any violent group, and... you know, the kinds of things we would do. And I gave that to the principal, but he wouldn't even read it, so it's kind of a waste of time.
Now, your mother has pulled you out of school?
Right, yeah.
And what are you doing?
Homeschool. It's so funny. I mean, you realize how much crap they're feeding you in public schools, like, all order. Like, I don't know. I get on the computer, like, once every 4 days and just finish up, like, a whole chapter. So it's not bad.
When did you decide to sue the school?
Well, it's not, I don't know, it was like a few days afterward, after I emailed like a whole bunch of people, and someone called me back, like it was weird, and then we went to their office, and then we called the school, and then they said they agreed with, like, letting me wear my shirts again and starting the club, and because they didn't want to go to court, I guess. But then the next Monday is when they went to the newspaper and said all those things. So then the next Tuesday we went to court. Dude.
Are you glad you wore the T-shirt?
Yeah, I would still wear it even. I mean, I think that's so stupid that I got suspended. I've worn it before, and I didn't get warned, and I would still wear it. Yeah, that's how I feel. I still feel that way.
What kind of response have you gotten at your school from the kids and also from students around the country, if anyone has heard your story?
Well, at school, they don't like me. I have about 7 friends, and they support me. They, like, have to walk me to my classes when I went because people really wanted to hurt me, like guys wanted to hurt me. And then, like, everywhere else, I've got, like, a lot of support. I've received a lot of emails from some really cool kids out there who have been through the same thing, pretty much. It's amazing how many times it's happened.
Well, Katie, I want to thank you for joining us. What is your email address?
AnarchistGirly@AOL.com.
AnarchistGirly?
@AOL.com. Yeah.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Katie Sierra wore a T-shirt to school that said, "When I saw the dead and dying Afghani children on TV, I felt a newly recovered sense of national security. God bless America." She was suspended from school. Now she is homeschooling and suing her school in Charleston, West Virginia. You're listening to the War and Peace Report. When we come back, we'll go to Hampshire College speak with a student about the resolution they passed last week condemning the so-called war on terrorism, and we'll talk with someone who was against that resolution. Stay with us.
Broken bottles, broken plates, broken switches, broken gates, broken dishes, broken pots, streets are filled with broken hearts, broken words never meant to be spoken.
Everything is Broken. Bob Dylan. Dedicate this show to Bobby Minter, who is a huge Dylan fan. Bobby died last week. He was 48 years old. You are listening to the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Well, students are doing things all over the country in this time of war. In Massachusetts, in a groundbreaking move, the students, faculty, and staff of Hampshire College adopted a resolution last week condemning the so-called war on terrorism, saying military action will never put an end to international terrorism. The widely supported statement called for the resumption of effective independent humanitarian aid in Afghanistan and the independent halt to the U.S. military action that prevents it. We're joined right now by two students who were involved in this issue, one for, one against the resolution. Arnab Chakrabarty is with us, a senior at Hampshire College, a member of the student government, and Justin Jackson, who is a fourth-year student with Hampshire College Students for a Peaceful Response. Can you tell us what else this resolution said that was passed by the students, the staff, the faculty of Hampshire?
Well, Justin, do you want to go first?
Justin, are you there? Okay. Well, Arnab Chakrabarty, why don't you tell us why you opposed this resolution?
Well, first of all, the resolution purports to speak for many parties that were not involved in the actual decision-making process, namely people of the people of Afghanistan and quote-unquote, people of color across the world. And I think I also have a major reservation about the actual process that was followed, you know, in the process of the process that was followed to come to this so-called resolution. It was basically an all-campus vote, which was conducted outside of any, you know, mandated constitutional method, and it was conducted by the interested party using a student roster that was outdated as determined by the Dean of Students on December 10, 2001. The election ballots were collected and counted by the interested party and counted, well, by them. Students report having been intimidated and made uncomfortable by the party that conducted the vote, and they were also present when a lot of these students were making up their mind, seeing their statement for the first time. And I think another thing that I'd like to go on record saying is that an abstention could not be counted towards a whole number of voters because that person chose not to vote. Students also reported having their names crossed off the list while voting, enabling the possibility of multiple votes. Community Council, which is the student government body of Hampshire College, did not approve this item to be taken to a referendum, and much of the voting procedures undertaken go against a set of rules in Article 9 of the Community Council bylaws.
Justin Jackson, can you tell us about how this vote came about and why you supported it?
Hello?
Yeah, can you hear me?
Yes.
Can you tell us how this vote came about and why you supported it?
Well, the vote came about because Students for a Peace Response at Hampshire College, which is a five-college organization, in the Pioneer Valley in Western Massachusetts here, we decided that we wanted to undertake something that would broaden the political space in the country, which is, as a lot of people know, it's really constricted at this point. There's not a lot of room for dissent, as Katie Sierra has found out in our schools, in our high schools. There's not a lot of room for dissent in our college and university classrooms. And we wanted to broaden the space that would be available for people to voice their dissent and have a diversity of political opinion in the country. So we decided that a all-community vote would be the best way to, first of all, register opinion on our campus and then project that out into the larger community that we live in and schools and other institutions in the country.
Arnab Chakrabarty just talked about why he opposed the vote, saying he didn't even trust the count. What was the count, by the way, Justin?
The count was officially 693 in favor of our statement, which was a page-long statement, and 121 voting against. There were two blank ballots and seven abstentions, actually.
Well, Arnab, that's a pretty big margin there,
uh-huh.
A victory. So even if there were some problems with some of the votes,
mm-hmm.
Do you doubt that that was the sense of the community at Hampshire?
Well, I think the problem in the first place is not with the mandate of the community. I think it was the process by which the election was, the voting was administered. And I also think that many people would have voted differently under a different set of circumstances. The process also involved a certain amount of coercion from the interested party. And I think that and also misrepresentation.
Coercion in what way, do you mean?
When I went to vote, I was asked by someone. The person actually came to my living area, to my living space, and walked in the door and asked me if I wanted to stop the killing of innocent millions. And my first reaction, obviously, was, yes, of course. I would like to aid any process that, you know, but that is definitely anti-violence, and that was my first reaction. But upon reading the statement, I realized very soon that there were many clauses within the statement that I did not agree with, and they were,
for example.
I think most importantly, I would like to point to certain clauses in the statement that basically says that it speaks for people of color and particularly seeks for stability and peace in South Asia, I think it doesn't take into account many nuances that govern the politics in the region. As a citizen of India, I express my resentment at being represented by SBR and also my solidarity with the American nation in the aftermath of the horrific acts of September 11.
Justin, your response.
Well, you know, the statement speaks for itself, and the community voted for it by a far majority. As for representing people of color, Hampshire's a very diverse community, and there are people from South Asia who are involved in our group getting the vote who are very behind the vote. So it's a diverse community, and there's going to be diverse opinions.
The statement said, we call for a UN-led effort to establish Afghanistan, a democratic, multi-ethnic government, respectful of the rights of women. Furthermore, demand the Hampshire administration join us in resisting any arbitrary and unfair law enforcement invasion of our own community, especially efforts targeting international students and campus activists, and concluded we must, in the words of Martin Luther King Jr., rededicate ourselves to the long and bitter but beautiful struggle for a new world. A world where hunger, war, and economic justice are eliminated. This way alone leads to safety, security, and lasting peace. It's believed to be the first such decision by a college community in the United States. Arnab Chakrabarty, just talking about that issue of targeting of students and not having the Hampshire administration participate in that, the idea of turning over records, et cetera. How do you feel about that?
Well, I do not think interested group, Students for a Peaceful Response, even actively and genuinely solicited the administration's participation. I think, they did come to us. I'm a member of Hampshire Student Government, the Community Council, and did request that this point be put out to referendum by council, but we could not come to consensus or any sort of agreement about the same, and we found the statement to be highly problematic, and we could not vote in favor of conducting a referendum. And therefore, I think their referendum was not institutional. It did not have any sort of institutional support. And I think the community's voice and our collective name as an institution was hijacked.
Kiara Johnson also joins us on the line as we go to students around the country. She's with the National Youth and Student Peace Coalition, which was just launched yesterday on Monday in Washington, D.C., at the Japanese-American War Memorial. Kiara Johnson, tell us about this new group.
The National Youth and Peace and Student National Youth and Student Peace Coalition, like you said, is a coalition of organizations, and actually it's one of the best things about this coalition of groups that have not traditionally come together to work around a specific issue. Groups from the Campus Greens to the Black Radical Congress to the United States Student Association and ourselves, the Campaign for Access and Reproductive Equity. Basically, youth and student groups that have come together and want to put a new progressive youth and student voice in response to the negative responses that the U.S. government has made to 9/11.
Can you talk about why you, who are part of a reproductive rights youth organization begun by Gloria Steinem, would join these efforts on the issue of war right now?
Choice USA is the organization that I work for, and Choice USA was the organization founded by Gloria Steinem, but the CARE campaign, the Campaign for Access and Reproductive Equity, is a coalition of over 170 reproductive rights organizations, and it's actually it's a program of the National Network of Abortion Funds in Massachusetts. Basically, CARE 2000 and the Campus Committee, of whom I represent, have been concerned in fighting against the silencing and curtailing of the civil liberties of low-income women, women of color, and young women since 1992. And with the emergence of this new coalition in response to 9/11, we saw an opportunity to work with other youth and students who also are disturbed by this response. And, like the other organizations in this coalition, CARE recognizes that in opposing the government response, it's more than just about opposing the war, but about opposing these gag orders on voices of dissension, and it's about opposing defining what American and patriotism has been described of in conservative ideal terms and in undemocratic and unconstitutional actions. And so, I mean, we've seen progressives, progressive agendas like reproductive rights issues labeled unpatriotic. And we've seen liberal and progressive legislators being silenced in fear of their dissension on an issue being deemed as an act of treason. So our goal with the rest of the coalition is to reclaim and redefine these terms, democratic, patriotic, and security, and to address members of Congress and have them respond to the coalition demands.
And why your group was launched at the Japanese American Memorial in Washington?
That was a space that the United States Student Association helped us get. And basically, there's a quote that basically lends to the fact that we don't want to see the civil liberties of Americans being overrun and taken over again. And it seemed to be a good place to launch in solidarity with our brothers and sisters from World War II.
Bill Lasher is also with us, a senior at Oberlin College School, where some of you are trying to pass a resolution similar to what happened at Hampshire. What's happening there?
Well, what we've been working on is trying to put together a statement that represents the broad range of opinions that exists on campus and that represents all facets of our community. We'd like the statement to emphasize the fact that our constitutional freedom is in danger and that we reject racist, ethnic, and religious scapegoating. Basically, we think that these are central values that must be sacrificed in every effort taken. That must not be sacrificed in efforts taken to to protect us.
And is there a battle brewing at your school over this?
I wouldn't say that there's a battle brewing at our school over this. I would just say that there's a lot of work to be done because we need to make sure that this statement, whatever is formed, represents a broad range of students on this campus and not just a particular segment of the campus.
Kiara Johnson, we just heard Arnab Chakrabarty talking about resenting that the resolution talked about people of color. As a woman of color yourself, how do you fit into this anti-war movement?
I think that, and again, with the coalition, the whole point was to bring in underrepresented groups, groups who are directly affected by the policies that the U.S. government are trying to put into place in the name of, you know, U.S. security, homeland security. And when dealing with trying to make racial profiling okay and anti-immigrant policies okay, it seems to be a perfect fit for me to be in opposition to the way the U.S. government is responding to this, not only in the blatant violence on innocent folks overseas, but what's happening here at home. The civil liberties being completely annihilated and people being silenced, I think as women and as women of color, as people of color, that we've seen this, and this is nothing new, and yet we're expected to show our patriotism when, you know, again, we're expected to co-sign on racial profiling and co-sign on anti-immigrant policies in the name of being patriotic.
Well, Kiara Johnson, I want to thank you for being with us at the National Youth and Student Peace Coalition, Bill Lasher at Oberlin College, and the students at Hampshire as well. And you can get all their contact information at our website, democracynow.org, as we wrap up the program. It is produced by Chris Abrams, Brad Simpson, Miranda Kennedy, with help from Lizzie Ratner, Suganya Mahendra, and Matthew Power. Anthony Sloan is our engineer and music maestro. WBIX.org is broadcasting us. Jackie Suhan is our webmaster. Thanks to our satellite uplink engineer, Amy Pomerleau at KPFA, KFCF as well. We are broadcasting in exile from the embattled studios of BAI, the studios of the band, the fired studios of our listeners. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening. From Ground Zero Radio, this is Democracy Now in Exile.
If I had been them, if I had been encouraged to fight the Russians with weapons and money from the West, and then ignored, and then endured civil war, and then asked to fight the Taliban, and then had my homes, my home bombed by the Americans and then lost members of my family. I mean, I would try to beat up any Westerner I came across. I'd try to attack Robert Fisk, too.
Renowned British journalist Robert Fisk is beaten up by a crowd of angry Afghans. We'll speak to him in Pakistan. Then, as alternative media outlets become increasingly rare, the Feminist Majority Foundation buys Ms. Magazine, the trailblazing feminist publication that led the women's movement in the 70s. And finally, hundreds demonstrate for the Revolutionary Association of the Women of Afghanistan in Islamabad and Los Angeles. All that and more coming up. Welcome to the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Anti-Taliban forces, aided by fierce U.S. bombing, are claiming to have routed out al-Qaeda fighters and their families from a network of caves in the Tora Bora region in eastern Afghanistan, forcing them to retreat to nearby mountaintops where some appeared to be trying to arrange a surrender. It's not clear if all the al-Qaeda soldiers had been forced out of the caves, and there was no indication Osama bin Laden is among those who fled. Afghan troops say dozens of heavily armed U.S. soldiers, thought to be from special forces units, made lightning raids against key al-Qaeda positions overnight as part of the assault by hundreds of Mujahideen fighters. They were aided by continued intense U.S. bombardment, which yesterday included the use of 15,000-pound fuel, air, incendiary bombs, euphemistically called daisy cutters, across the Afghan border and neighboring Pakistan. Pakistani soldiers have been deployed on mountains south of Tora Bora to stop al-Qaeda fighters from crossing over. And the New York Times is reporting scores of Taliban prisoners died after surrendering to Northern Alliance forces, asphyxiated in the shipping containers they were packed in while being transported to prison. Witnesses say the deaths occurred as the prisoners were brought from the town of Kunduz to the prison in the town of Shibigargan, a journey that took 2 or 3 days. Prisoners describe gruesome scenes in which hundreds of men desperately sought to breathe in the virtually airtight containers. One youth said through the bars of his prison wing, at least 100 had suffocated in his container alone. No oxygen, no oxygen, he said urgently in English. The White House last night said it would release a video of Osama bin Laden in the next 48 hours in which he allegedly says the destruction of the World Trade Center towers was far greater than he'd expected. The video also allegedly shows bin Laden appearing amused that some of the hijackers involved in the September 11th attacks were not aware that they were going to die. U.S. officials say the video represents a smoking gun conclusively proving bin Laden's prior knowledge of the suicide attacks. The tape was found in Jalalabad 11 days ago in a private home. And the Financial Times is reporting that U.S. military advisors visited Somalia on Sunday for talks with opposition clan leaders to identify potential targets for U.S. military strikes. The British government will head an international force of 4,000 troops in the next 2 weeks that'll deploy in Afghanistan for a 3-month period. At least 1,000 German troops are also expected to participate. The troops will stay during the launch of the interim government before handing over to a larger multinational effort led by Turkey. Northern Alliance and other forces are worried about the British taking the lead in such a deployment, given their role in military operations with the U.S. that have killed thousands of Afghan civilians. But British Prime Minister Tony Blair said there was no contradiction in allowing British forces that previously had been attacking Afghanistan to be involved in non-offensive capabilities. Israeli helicopters killed 2 children, including a 3-year-old boy, when they fired missiles at cars in a crowded street in the West Bank city of Hebron yesterday in a failed attempt to assassinate a suspected member of Islamic Jihad. 7 other people were injured. The attack was immediately cited by Palestinian officials as further evidence that the Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon was heightening the conflict to consolidate Israel's occupation of the West Bank and Gaza and foreclose any possibility of meaningful negotiations. Here in the United States, the Supreme Court agreed yesterday to decide whether former Secretary of State Warren Christopher and former President Bill Clinton could be sued by human rights lawyer Jennifer Harbury for deliberately misleading her about the fate of her Guatemalan husband. The officials are accused of lying about what the U.S. knew about the 1994 kidnapping, torture, and execution of Efraín Bámica Velásquez by a Guatemalan officer on the payroll of a Central Intelligence Agency. After years of denying any link between illness and service in the Persian Gulf War, military officials said yesterday that veterans of the conflict were nearly twice as likely to suffer from Lou Gehrig's disease as other soldiers. So far, some 40 veterans have been diagnosed with the disease, which causes severe muscle wasting and is typically fatal in 2 to 5 years. The Department of Veterans Affairs said it would immediately offer disability and survivor benefits to veterans with the disease who served in the Persian Gulf during the conflict a decade ago. Higher Ground, Stevie Wonder, here on the War and Peace Report, broadcasting just blocks from where the towers of the World Trade Center once stood, outside a police checkpoint where U.S. soldiers, National Guard, and police continue to check cars and vans and people for their documents. I'm Amy Goodman. Renowned British journalist Robert Fisk was severely beaten by a crowd of people in an Afghan village just 2 days ago and barely escaped with his life. He wrote just after the incident, quote, "Some of the Afghans in the little village had been there for years. Others had arrived desperate and angry and mourning their slaughtered loved ones over the past 2 weeks. What happened to us was symbolic of the hatred and fury and hypocrisy of this filthy war. A growing band of destitute Afghan men, young and old, who saw foreigners, enemies in their midst and tried to destroy at least one of them. Many of these Afghans, so we were to learn, were outraged by what they'd seen on TV of the Mazar-i-Sharif massacres, of the prisoners killed with their hands tied behind their backs. A villager later told one of our drivers they'd seen the videotape of CIA officers Mike and Dave threatening death to a kneeling prisoner at Mazar. They were uneducated. I doubt if many could read, but you don't have to have a schooling to respond to the death of loved ones under B-52 bombs. At one point, a screaming teenager had turned to my driver and asked in all sincerity, 'Is that Mr. Bush?' Robert Fisk went on to say in this piece that described his beating, 'I thought I should write about what happened to us in this fearful, silly, bloody, tiny incident. I feared other versions would produce a different narrative of how a British journalist was beaten up by a mob of Afghan refugees.'" Well, we turn to Robert Fisk now. I interviewed him yesterday. He had reached Quetta, Pakistan, where he was recovering. And I just asked him to start by talking about how he was feeling.
Mother of all headaches, as Saddam Hussein might say. But no, I'm feeling better. Obviously, at the time, when you see yourself covered in blood, it's a very disturbing experience, also because you realize that here were people who wanted to hurt you and indeed wanted to kill you. You know, it does bring you face to face with the, you know, the reality of the way people feel when they feel humiliated and oppressed, I suppose, is the old socialist word, and the way in which when they feel that they're being, their families are being killed, you can see the brute force of a whole people who feel that they're being destroyed by the West, if you like. And obviously, I was, so to speak, the symbol of the West in this incident, and my colleague Justin, to some extent, though enough to get on the bus, and he tried to pull me onto it, a bus where the driver was trying to rescue us. But I think, as you know, I wrote in my article in the Independent of London this morning, that if I had been them, if I had been encouraged to fight the Russians with weapons and money from the West, and then ignored, and then endured civil war, and then asked to fight the Taliban, and then had my home bombed by the Americans, and then lost members of my family, I mean, I would try to beat up any Westerner I came across. I'd try to attack Robert Fisk too. So, you know, it is impossible for me to feel anger against the people who did this. I mean, they shouldn't have done it, but that's not an argument that works in the kind of brutal landscape that we have helped to create out here. So my overall feeling is that, you know, who can possibly blame them? striking back against the terrible things that happened to them.
Robert, can you tell us exactly what happened and when it happened?
Yes, it was Saturday afternoon. I was traveling from the border town of Quetta in Pakistan down towards the frontier post at Chaman, towards a mountain chain that runs parallel with Afghanistan. And at a village called Kila Abdullah, which by great misfortune to us houses many thousands of Afghan refugees, the boiler started to boil over in the car, the radiator, and steam started to come out of the radiator as the car stopped in the middle of the road, in the middle of this crowded village, full, of course, of angry people. Angry, as we learned later, not only because they'd lost many relatives in the Kandahar, which is only about 90, 80 miles away as the crow flies from the village, but also because they'd been outraged by the film of the prisoners who'd in Mazar-e-Sharif, most of whom were Pashtuns, as the refugees were in this village. They had seen also the videotape, so we were told later, of the CIA agents, Dave and Mike, interviewing, or rather interrogating, the Muslim man kneeling on the floor with his hands tied behind his back. So obviously when two Westerners, Justin Hugler and myself, suddenly turned up with a broken car in the middle of the village, we became... Well, first of all, actually, we became friends. We went around, people came around the car, we said, Salaam Alaikum, peace be upon you, Alaikum Salaam, and we shook hands, and people gave us a sort of two-handed handshake. And everything was all right for about a minute. The driver went off to get a new, you know, a fresh car, a taxi. The translator stood next to us. And then we decided there was too big a crowd. A lot of the men were bearded. They were not smiling anymore. We moved towards the center of the road, very crowded road, because, you see, we blocked the road and the car broke down, so a lot of people, a lot of traffic. And let's just move out of here into the center of the road, get away from the crowd, but the crowd followed us. And as we walked, a little boy sort of snapped his finger against my wrist rather hard. I hoped that it was just, you know, a joke. Then a pebble spun over my shoulder and hit Justin on the shoulder. And we looked at each other, Justin's eyes full of concern, and we realized something was going wrong there. We then found ourselves being jostled, pushed, punched, not very much, but a little bit, and we suddenly saw a bus driver beckoning us to get on his bus. It was heading back to Quetta. Justin made it onto the bus. I put the first step up, boys and young men, grabbed the blue satchel that was around my shoulder, the satchel in which I carry my passport, credit cards, papers, etc., and tried to pull me back. Justin reached out his hand, and I grasped it. But he tried to pull me on. The crowd were pulling me back, and in the end, they did go of his hand. And they were shouting. I don't know what they were shouting. I don't speak Pashto. I can speak Arabic. And then they started really hit me, first of all on the back, then the shoulders, and then I had fists on the face, and then stones sort of bouncing off my shoulders and bouncing off my head, and then two men came up and started to bash me on the face and the head with stones, and very quickly, there was running down my face, a man came up and smashed my glasses into my face. There was blood in my eyes, I couldn't see, I was short-sighted, and then I couldn't see at all. I felt my shirt going wet with blood, my pullover was drenched in it, it began splashing on my shoes and trousers. And I was obviously in a difficult situation because although there were 60 at the beginning, I thought there were around 100 people by the time I was bleeding. You know, it was like a bloody horse being slaughtered. It sort of attracted people in an animal-like way, which I don't like to think about. And I was then on my own. Justin and I had lost our grip of each other. And I remembered Lebanese always said, if you're in danger, whatever you do, don't do nothing. So the next man, well, actually, he'd already hit me once. There was a man with a stone who wanted to bash it into my face again. So I hit him with my fist, and I just saw out of the corner of my eye, he spat his tooth out. In fact, on my right wrist now, I've got a big scar from the tooth which I knocked out. And then I went for three other people. I missed one and hit two others and started running. And just for a moment, the crowd held back because, you know, the dying creature, so to speak, had suddenly come alive again, and that was obviously what I intended. And then I ran down the road, and at one point a figure came out. I was standing in the road, the glasses had gone, they'd ripped off my spare pair. I'd actually, unfortunately, also, I later discovered, taken my contacts book away with 25 years of names and telephone numbers around the Middle East that had dropped out of my bag when they were trying to seize it. And I was trying desperately with my fingers to push the blood out of my eyes, and I saw this figure come that took me very gently by the right arm, man in robe with a kind of turban and a beard. I didn't really see his face. I didn't concentrate. I kept saying, help me, salam alaikum, peace be upon you. And I think he was some kind of religious person, a cleric, a mullah, perhaps, a Muslim, of course, in the village. And as he led me away, the crowd sort of paused, and they sent stones after me, but skittering along the road, not at me, in case they hit the man. So he must have been important in the village. And he put me on board a little police truck we found, and they were too terrified to move. And I was on the truck. I climbed up towards the back of the cab with a little window, and I kept banging on it, saying, help me, help me. And I remember my blood was sort of streaming down the window behind them. And they drove about 15 meters forward. Then the religious man came back and obviously told them to help me more. And they then drove about 300 meters. And there, like a miracle, incredibly, was a Red Cross, Red Crescent convoy. And two Bangladeshi Muslim doctors immediately took me out of the back of the police vehicle and started to pour water over my wounds because my hands were just crimson. I mean, it looked like a scene from, you know, Christians to the Lions in the Colosseum. And they quickly put a bandage around my head, and they started, you know, putting wads of bandages on all the wounds I had and told me to lie on the floor of the ambulance and threw a blanket over me so that when the first people arrived, which they quickly did, didn't recognize me. And then they got me out, and Justin, my colleague, very fortunately, he got out of the bus. The people there didn't help us, but they didn't hurt him. And he eventually found himself close to his car and in his car, protected by a very stout man belonging to an organization called the Baluchistan Levies, obviously originally raised under the British Mandate. And he was there with a rifle and just threatened back the crowd to keep away from Justin. And in due course, in fact, we were reunited further down the road when I was still with the Red Cross convoy. So we then came back, very much tail between our legs, of course, to Quetta, where we were able to have our wounds dressed again and washed, and where two, well, not ours, I had wounds, Justin was just pushed around a bit, and two doctors came and considerably painfully managed to sort of clip off bits of my hair, which were caked with blood, and put bandages on me.
Robert Fisk describing what happened to him just how many days ago was it?
It was a day and a half ago. It feels like a week now, but it was a day and a half ago.
And so how did you ultimately end up where you are right now?
Well, I'm still where I got back to in Quetta. I'm in my hotel room. I obviously spent the next day sleeping somewhat fitfully because immediately to turn around in bed, the crowd of people were kicking me as well, so I've got bruises all over my back and my shoulder and my legs and my sides. So even to turn around in bed is actually quite painful. But you quickly get your appetite back if you're going to be all right. And I must say, I refused a tetanus injection, refused stitches, because I somehow hate those things. but I'll have a couple of scars on my face. But otherwise, the doctors, the Pakistani doctors who came here, said I would be all right. So I will. So I'm carrying on reporting as best I can.
So do you plan to leave, Robert?
Not at the moment. I think our job is to go on reporting. I was actually planning to go on holiday several days ago, and it was only when Kandahar fell that I decided to stay on. So I'm perfectly entitled, if I want, to leave at this minute, but I don't intend to, in fact.
Robert Fisk, just beaten up by a crowd of Afghan men and boys. He is now in Quetta, Pakistan, recovering. He is a longtime reporter for the independent newspaper in Britain, usually based in Beirut, Lebanon. Just came out of Afghanistan. You're listening to War and Peace Report. When we come back, Ms. Magazine has been sold yet again, now to the feminist majority. We'll speak with Eleanor Smeal, Gloria Steinem, and others about the magazine. Stay with us.
Woke up this morning and found I didn't care for you no more, no how. Never felt so good before. Thank you. size, it's over and done. So a highness, step down from your throne. That look in your eye don't bother me none. Can take you or leave you alone.
No more Billie Holiday here on the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. On a December 4th broadcast of the NBC Nightly News, firefighter Lieutenant Brenda Bergman described risking her life to save others. Although her story was similar to hundreds of tales we've heard from New York firefighters, Bergman's experience sounded unfamiliar when told in a woman's voice. Perhaps that's because it took nearly 3 months for NBC to discover that women rescue workers have toiled 24/7 at Ground Zero every day since the attacks. The fact that faces of women haven't been in the news or in the media is not reflective of reality, Bergman told NBC. Nor is reality reflected on the network's political debate shows or news stories, which frame and influence the public debate. According to a study released last week by the White House Project, a nonpartisan women's leadership group, women were just 11% of guests on five Sunday morning talk shows on ABC, NBC, CBS, CNN, and Fox between January 2000 and June 2001. A lot of these facts were put together by Jen Posner, who formerly headed the women's desk at Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. That's going to appear in an upcoming op-ed piece in Newsday. Well, it's this void that the feminist media fills. But in the last 3 months, women's and feminist magazines have been suffering. Both Mode magazine and Mademoiselle have ceased publication. ChickClick.com, a commercial women's site that had some progressive feminist news content, just went under. And Sojourner, the Women's Forum, the country's oldest consistently publishing feminist newspaper, has been greatly reduced in size. They've been fighting for their financial survival for years, and it's only gotten more difficult in recent months. Now, Ms. Magazine has been sold once again, and we're going to talk today about its new reincarnation. When the preview issue of Ms. appeared tucked inside New York Magazine in December 1971, carrying articles on subjects such as the housewife's moment of truth and de-sexing the English language, the syndicated New York Times columnist James J. Kilpatrick jeered that it was a C-sharp on an untuned piano. This is a note of petulance, of bitchiness, or nervous fingernail screeching across a blackboard. And after the first regular issue came out in July of that year, the network news anchor Harry Reasoner announced to America, "I'll give it 6 months before they run out of things to say." At the time, the fledgling feminist movement was either denigrated or dismissed in the mainstream media, if talked about at all. But the issue flew off the newsstands, and Ms. Magazine came to symbolize the women's movement of the 70s. As the movement changed, so did the magazine, battling for its independence for 30 years. Unique, outspoken, and hard-hitting, Ms. has consistently faced financial instability and advertiser resistance. In his last incarnation, a group of feminist investors started a women's media company that ran Ms. The newly women-owned Ms., which has been ad-free since 1990, was relaunched in 99. The same year, the company launched the Ms. website, and in October 2000, held the magazine's first major conference. Well, several weeks ago, Ms. announced that the Feminist Majority Foundation had bought the magazine. We're joined right now by Gloria Steinem to give us a little more history of the magazine and to talk about its new owner, Feminist Majority. And Ellie Smeal is with us as well, co-founder and president of Feminist Majority. Gloria Steinem, talk about all of these shifts, please, and what you expect to come out of this new Ms.
The biggest shift, in a way, in the past was from advertising or trying to get advertising, often without success, to no advertising. I say that because I want the listeners to know that there is a path besides the commercial one. That is, Ms. Magazine became financially viable for the first time when it stopped taking advertising. And also, I should say that the magazine was not sold to the Feminist Majority Foundation. It was contributed by the women who had purchased it and set it free and given it its own financial independence back again because it has always been the purpose of the magazine to support the movement. And we hope and believe that when it becomes profitable again, it will be supporting the activism of the Feminist Majority Foundation.
Ellie Smeal, can you talk about your plans for Ms. Magazine under the Feminist Majority?
Well, we're really excited about it. We want to keep the spirit of Ms., and Gloria is going to stay a part of it, but also many of the people who've been contributing and the writers. And then we're hoping to add to it, too, so we feel that we're going to combine forces, and we will add is the activism of our, not only our many projects, but we hope that through our working with many, many other organizations, we can highlight theirs. And so we think that the combined forces will make Ms. much stronger.
Now, I know a lot of the staff of Ms. has been let go. Who is going to run the new Ms.?
Well, that's what we're in the search of. One of the major reasons, of course, that we're going to have some changes is because we're moving the editorial base to Los Angeles. We're moving into a new building in Los Angeles, and again, we think the combination of forces, it'll have a strong home there and new facilities. But unfortunately, some of the folks, obviously, it's a long distance from New York. On the other hand, we'd like to keep many of the writers and the contributors from New York, so we want to be truly bi-coastal.
Jen Posner joins us in our studio. She's the former Women's Desk Director at Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting and writes and lectures on women in the media. What are your concerns about Ms. Magazine today?
Well, I have always thought that Ms. fills an incredibly needed void. Like we were talking about, like you said in the opening of the show, women are faring ever more poorly in representation in the mainstream media. So Ms. has been a space where women's stories and women's voices could be explored domestically, internationally, a lot of hard-hitting issues. A lot of what I've done in the last few years has been to focus on problems that arise when media outlets, whether they're owned by, say, some big evil corporation with a certain corporate agenda, or whether they're owned by an independent organization that has its own maybe positive agenda, sometimes the editorial priorities will bump up against the agendas of organizations. What I'm wondering about, and I don't have necessarily concerns that it won't go well. I'm hearing from people that they're wondering about what will happen when Ms. is no longer strictly an independent voice that is only editorially controlled by the editors, but has sort of an overseeing organizational body. Doesn't necessarily mean it could be a bad thing. It could be a great thing with added resources, added activism, coalition bases, etc. But I'm wondering about issues that may come up that, say, the editorial staff might want to cover that might not be a big priority for Feminist Majority. Not that I think that the issues would be automatically against each other.
Ellie Smeal, your response.
Well, we are going to maintain an independent board for Ms., and we understand the importance of its independence, and we do not want it to become a house organ. And so basically, just because, you know, the Feminist Majority isn't working in an area does not mean that we would not be covering it at all, because essentially, as I say, the independent spirit of the magazine is its value, one of its greatest assets. So what we're hoping, though, is in those areas where we have, you know, research ability and where we have actual people on the ground and that we can actually help it. And so we're hoping that it will not only keep independent, but that the resources of the movement will be more available to it.
And Jen and Amy, we are so grateful for you as independent voices out there. Amy, I was listening last night to your report about the reality of the murders of Afghanistan citizens by U.S. bombing, the numbers, and that information just isn't available anyplace else. You can do that in a timely way. I hope that we can do it in a more, that Ms. can continue to do it in a more analytical and contextual way. I mean, for instance, when you were talking about the absence of reporting of women and what had happened to them on September 11th and their heroism, three of our Women of the Year in this current issue, which begins the 30th anniversary issue, are women who gave their lives to save others in September 11th and also haven't been reported. So there's no shortage of work to do here.
I wanted to ask about that issue of connecting feminism and anti-war activism. I saw a remarkable moment in CNN history just about a week ago, and it was, Gloria, when you were on with Paula Zahn. You were there to talk about the future of women in Afghanistan, and I can't remember what exactly you said, but it led Paula Zahn to say, just a minute, this is a little off topic, but you're not saying, are you, that you're against the bombing of Afghanistan? And she looked absolutely shocked, as she should be, because I don't think I've heard one voice against war on CNN right now. Now, you didn't write out say yes, but what are your views on the bombing of Afghanistan, and how would that play into a new Ms? I'd also ask like to ask Ellie Smeal that question.
Well, I don't represent the new Ms. I'm the old Ms, really, but I will continue to be there as a writer and as a contributor. So my individual views are that we have not yet truly carved out the sensible, effective place where we need to be, because it is not just pro or anti-war, but doing what is effective. The analogy for terrorism seems to me to be crime much more than it is war. So yes, indeed, this was a crime against humanity. You do need to pursue the criminals, but you don't want to kill the innocent along the way. So it's a different position from the Vietnam era, when more clearly we shouldn't have been there at all. It's much more like trying to rescue people in a concentration camp and manage to do that and do away with the guards without also punishing the prisoners.
Are you against the war as it's being waged right now?
As it's being waged, I would say against 80% of it, yes.
And Ellie Smeal, how about you? I mean, the feminist majority has taken a very strong stance against the Taliban well before what has happened, you know, well before September 11th. Is the feminist majority against the bombing of Afghanistan?
Well, again, it always sounds like a hedge when we start, but I don't think it's that black and white. I do think it's necessary to end the Taliban reign, but obviously you don't want bombing that isn't that's killing innocent people. So you have to cut it in between, and we always look like we're hedging when we're not. Basically, we don't know what this bombing has done. That's why it's so important to have independent reports. But we do know that that we have to free these people. I like the analogy that Gloria just gave of that you're liberating the concentration camps. I'm not quite sure why we've always been so reluctant to put people on the ground, more people on the ground, because to me the risk of bombing is that you're killing innocent civilians, and you're just if this place is rubble, and you're sort of rearranging the rubble. When people say it's a brilliant strategy, I don't quite understand what that means, because essentially there hasn't been a large there's 45,000 soldiers at best of the Taliban, and I say at best. I think that they've never been a match, and if you can cut off the supplies, as we did, and many other things, they do crumble. One of our problems, and I think that we shouldn't, as feminists right now, dwell on something we couldn't have an effect on at this moment, but what we can have an effect on, and a major effect, is what happens in the reconstruction. In the reconstruction, we cannot just leave them at a subsistence economy with women still not really having freedom. And so I think we have a huge amount of work to do to make sure that this economy is not only rebuilt, but that, in fact, women are a major part of the I hope, a democracy. I mean, none of this is sure, and there's so much to do. One of the things I want for a change is us fighting for, there's going to be billions of dollars here, and I hope that women's organizations in Afghanistan are a part of the funding mechanism, that it doesn't go around them and somehow they are still left paupers. But I hope that, that women's organizations and women's leaders are also funded and that they are part and parcel of the rebuilding. There can't be a rebuilding of this civilization unless women have a front and center part of it.
I want to go to the editor of Bitch Magazine in a minute, but Jen Posner of, well, formerly of Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, you wanted to respond.
Well, I'm interested. It's interesting to me to hear that both Gloria and Ellie talking about the need for independent reports. I think that is very true. I think that one of the things Ms. can do really well going forward is to talk to the many feminists and progressive women in the peace and anti-war movement right now who haven't been reported and who are doing a lot of really important work around reconstruction, but are also currently doing a lot of work to try and halt the bombing and to try and pressure the government to continue doing the work that FM has been doing for many years around women's repression and ending women's repression under the Taliban regime, but also to stop what we know as vengeance and not justice.
And also to listen, I mean, most importantly in this case, as is implicit in what as Ellie is saying and what I'm saying, to listen to the women on the ground themselves in Afghanistan and serve as microphones or megaphones for their voices. It's very clear, for the most part, that they wanted to be delivered from the Taliban. It's also very clear that they're suffering from the bombing. I fear that our own peace movement is still back in the Vietnam era of all or nothing without seeing the necessity of liberation, but without devastation, which is really what most of the Afghan women's groups are saying.
We're also joined by Lisa Maya Jervis, editor of Bitch Magazine, which is a magazine devoted to portraying a feminist response to pop culture. What would you like to bring into this discussion, Lisa? And also, given that you deal particularly with pop culture, there's been a lot of discussion of bringing Hollywood into the effort to support war, rushing films like Black Hawk Down ahead a few months to glorify the U.S. military.
Well, I think that getting Hollywood involved in war, well, first of all, it has a pretty long history. I mean, propaganda films are not new, and now we're just going to get a whole new crop of them, which I think is very unfortunate. Our entire experience is very mediated right now. There are very few people in this country who have any experience of what's going on in Afghanistan that is not completely 100% mediated, and up till now it's been by the news, but now there's going to be added this Hollywood element, which allows for even more glorification of military solutions, and that the scriptwriters can basically write the endings that they want, which many people know are not the endings that are gonna happen in real life. But those endings can be used to marshal support for what the government has chosen to be the solution to this problem.
It's interesting. In the next few days, we're going to be talking about this new movie, Black Hawk Down. President Clinton described what happened in Somalia with the famous picture of the U.S. Special Forces soldier being dragged through the streets. This was in October of 1993, as, you know, America's darkest hour, American military's darkest hour. But now they've kind of rejiggered it to be the greatest moment in U.S. military history, this period in Somalia when 18 U.S. soldiers were killed and it's believed more than 1,000 Somalis died.
We have to break for stations to identify themselves, but we're going to continue this discussion in 60 seconds with Lisa Meyer-Jervis, editor of Bitch Magazine, Jen Posner, an independent reporter, formerly with Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, Ellie Smeal, president of Feminist Majority Foundation, which has just bought Ms. Magazine, and Gloria Steinem, co-founder of Ms. Magazine. You're listening to the War and Peace Report. Back in a minute.
Come on, people, sons and mothers, keep the dream of the two young brothers. Gonna take that dream and ride that dove. We could build a dream with love, I know. We could build a dream with love, I know. We could build a dream with love, children. We could build a dream with love, oh people. We could build a dream with love, I know. We could build a dream with love.
You are listening to the War and Peace Report, Resistance Radio. I'm Amy Goodman. So we're joined in the largest public media collaboration in the country, broadcasting on internet at WBIX.org, on community radio stations around the country, on public access TV stations around the country, and on satellite television on Dish Network Channel 9415, which is Free Speech TV's 24-hour channel. We're also broadcasting on shortwave radio. And we're talking about media. We're talking about women's media, Ms. Magazine, that has just been taken over by the Feminist Majority Foundation, certainly well known for its publicizing of what the Taliban has done in Afghanistan well before 9/11, and now very much at the forefront of that issue. Ellie Smeal is with us, president of the Feminist Majority Foundation, Gloria Steinem, co-founder of Ms. Magazine, which began in 1971. Many in the mainstream media said it would have a very short life. Jen Posner is with us, an independent reporter, and Lisa Meyer-Jervis, editor of Bitch Magazine, a magazine devoted to portraying a feminist response to pop culture. Lisa Meyer-Jervis, how are you dealing with the war today?
Well, we are a very, very small magazine. We have two editorial staff members, and we split our time with the business side of the magazine as well. So we really don't have the resources to do any reporting, but we are pointing our readers toward progressive media sources where they can get what we consider to be helpful information. We wish we could do more original reporting, but, you know, we're a pop culture magazine. It's just not possible.
Let me ask Ellie Smeal. Ms. was awarded the Best Social Commentary Magazine by Utney Reader last year. You are now moving from New York, where Ms. was, to Los Angeles. Why did you decide to do that, and also, letting go of the staff?
Okay, well, basically, one of the things I wanted to, you know, call attention to again was that we didn't buy it, and I think it's important to understand that is that the current shareholders agreed to transfer their shares to us, which was in a very movement-like thing. I mean, it wouldn't happen in normal business, but it's because they are so dedicated to keeping it going and keeping an independent voice for feminism. But basically, to fight all the the difficulty of magazines right now, to improve the finances, we had to make some changes. And to make us stronger, we feel that we'll have an economy of scale this way. We have these offices, we have the space, and so essentially it's our way to not only give shelter but to cut expenses. We will have we have offices both in Los Angeles and in Virginia, right outside of Washington, and we're going to maintain a Washington bureau here so that we can report on the politics. But what we want to do and what we are doing is trying to maximize the resources of Ms. by combining the two operations. And we think that it will improve the bottom line of the magazine without really changing some of its basic premises on not being just a magazine that depended upon advertising of a commercial sort that, you know, changes really the nature of the magazine itself.
Let me ask Gloria Steinem something as we talk about this magazine in this time of war. At the top of the segment, I talked about NBC and the overall statistics on women who are covered and the voices that are heard in times of war. I mean, it is rare except for the, if you can call them, yeah, I don't think reporters, news readers on television right now, to see women commenting in any way. And I wonder if that's because, aside from just general sexism, that women tend to be more against war and militarism than men, so they really don't fit in this conversation.
Well, all the more reason they should be in the conversation, because we now have wars in which the civilian population suffers far more than those in uniform, and in which the numbers of refugees are continually larger, and they're almost totally women and children. So, you know, are we discussing the reality of foreign policy and military policy as if everyone mattered, or are we discussing it as a private game between a few folks in uniform? If we're having a discussion that is the accurate one, that looks at the total, then that's even more reason why women need to be part of it. And I do think that this is a particular kind of opportunity to say that, because we need to have a foreign policy, so to speak, you know, as if women mattered. When I looked back at the coverage that Ms. Magazine has done over the years of women in the Middle East in general and in Afghanistan in particular, it begins to get really intense in around 1980 when the Mujahideen went to war with the Soviet-backed regime for three reasons, because girls were being allowed to go to school, which they objected to, because women were being allowed to come to political meetings, which they objected to, and because the marriage laws were being changed so that women couldn't be married off against their will. We reported that in Ms., and I remember a lot of us standing up in a State Department meeting and saying, wait a minute, we're on the wrong side here, you know, what's going on? But $3 billion later of aid to the Mujahideen, including Osama bin Laden, we find ourselves having created the Taliban. So I would say it's the other way around, that the country in general and policymakers altogether need to listen. If they had been listening to the feminist majority or reading Ms. Magazine, arguably we wouldn't be where we are today. And even people like Rashid, who wrote a book called Taliban, which is now very popular and I think a very helpful and good book, though he is no feminist, point to the fact that it was the feminist movement that kept the United States from supporting and recognizing the Taliban even more than we did, since they were being invited to Texas and feted because of the potential oil pipeline and so on. So, you know, it's even more necessary now.
Jen Posner.
I think that it's very true that it's incredibly important to have women and critically independent women's voices represented in media coverage of this current crisis, responses to terrorism and war. But more importantly than just women's voices, we need to think about the gradations of which women. Because as always in mainstream media, when women do speak, a great number of them are from groups like the Independent Women's Forum or right-wing organizations, etc. Which is a right-wing funded anti-feminist organization that has, you know, just a shred of the percentage of numbers in membership that a group like FM might have, but they get a lion's share of media coverage. So when we're talking about independent feminist media, I think it's, I know that Ms. has the current issue, I believe, has a 30-page spread on terrorism and war and women. I did a piece for that issue talking about censorship in the mainstream media. I'm hoping that we can continue with Ms. to challenge critically what government policy is. I think Gloria's right when she says that we need to be questioning foreign policy right now, and that's an incredibly important role for the independent press to take. And when it comes to the independent feminist press, we should be hearing from more often from women like Laura Flanders, who does a daily column for Working for Change that focuses on a broad range of progressive responses to this war and this crisis. I mean, but what we're seeing, well, basically what we need the feminist press to be doing, what I hope that Ms. continues to do under new leadership, regardless of editorial policies or particular pet projects of FM. I mean, when you talk about a pet project, there's no better pet project to have than helping women in Afghanistan. But we need to be expanding the debate, and I hope that Ms. continues to do that, because when you talk about op-eds being written by women in the first month after the war, the New York Times, the Washington Post, and USA Today, I did a survey and found that women wrote 8%. Of those op-eds. And more importantly, I think, even than those paltry numbers, are the fact that overall, women and men, who the spokespeople on debate shows, the op-ed writers, etc., the pundits, these people have been, the majority of whom have been expressing a very staunch pro-war point of view, because so many of them are FBI affiliated or formerly with the CIA or currently or formerly elected or local, regional, or federal officials. So there's a certain line that's being espoused in mainstream media. Mostly that's a male line. They're all doing their best impersonations of John Wayne. What we need to be doing in the feminist press, and I have a lot of hope that Ms. will continue to be able to do this, is break through that.
It's interesting that you have Laura Bush giving a Saturday radio address, the first time a first lady had done this. And in this case, it was from the fiercely conservative Bush administration. Mm-hmm. Hillary Clinton for 8 years never did that. Now she is senator. Gloria Steinem, your response to that?
Well, I'm sure if Hillary had done it, we would be hearing, but she is not elected and so on from the right wing. Mm. You know, I say by any means necessary, if she can bring attention to what women in Afghanistan need, I'm all for it. But unfortunately, what she did was also be inaccurate at the same time by saying that the Taliban was the only force that had denied women in Afghanistan an education, ignoring the Mujahideen that was supported by the U.S., ignoring the situation in Saudi Arabia and Kuwait. So, you know, it was only that particular small portion of the plight of women in Afghanistan which exactly fit into her husband's priorities. Underneath that is the fact that, for instance, if women in Afghanistan are raped, as they are being every day, and choose not to have the child of their rapist, and therefore have an abortion, even with their own community resources and funds, they risk having every bit of money, U.S. aid, withdrawn from Afghanistan because of Bush's policy, which says this must happen. There's a similar problem for women in the armed services. You know, women who join up lose their rights, lose their reproductive rights. We ought to have posters that say, join the army and lose your rights. You know, so I think it called attention to something that the feminist majority has been calling attention to for 6 years, but it distorted that to fit into the very small and exact priorities of her husband.
I think that there's a definite, I agree with this description of media coverage as being opportunistic, actually. I've seen a lot of, well, not even a lot of coverage of women under the Taliban post 9/11, but what coverage I have heard has been in the form of, say, there was a piece called, I think, The Women of the War Room that Andrea Mitchell did for NBC. It was all about Karen Hughes and Condoleezza Rice and Mary Matlin and various Bush administration women who were waging the war effort, and they were talking about how great it is that women are in these wonderful positions of power of being able to stage this war. And there was, I don't remember the quote in front of me exactly, but there was a quote that said something like, and And these women are not only advancing for themselves, but the fact that these women are in the Bush administration is being used as a great sort of propaganda tool. They said it was part of the strategy. That's what Andrea Mitchell said. It was part of the strategy of responding to the Taliban. So was the piece that I referenced in my Newsday op-ed, the NBC thing the other day with the woman firefighter. The last closing bit of it was all about how we need to show America's heroes to the America's women heroes to the Taliban because we're including women in society and they aren't. So it's what are we dedicated in the press to uncovering what's going on and what has gone on in the past with the Northern Alliance and women? Not so much.
On that note, I wanted to bring in a last person in this last 2 minutes, and that is Sonali Kolatkar, who is with the Afghan Women's Mission in California, has been touring with the Revolutionary Association of Women of Afghanistan in Islamabad as well as Los Angeles. There were protests, which hundreds of women took part in yesterday to demonstrate for RAWA. Sonali, you've been a long time both a women's advocate in Afghanistan and anti-war activist.
Yes, that's right.
Your statement yesterday that was being made at the Los Angeles March.
What we wanted to say was that it was a terrible irony that the women of Afghanistan and the people of Afghanistan in general have been struggling for the very similar kinds of rights that we as Americans today are losing in this so-called war on terrorism. And we wanted to highlight the fact that it was so important today more than ever for Americans and immigrants to stand in solidarity with Afghans and to really say, no, we're not going to fight terror with more terror, state terror in Afghanistan. That's the United States terror in Afghanistan through their bombs and starvation, and state terror here in the United States against immigrants, and to really make those linkages, which are not made very often at all, and to bring to the forefront that our struggles are parallel and have to be parallel, and that we have got to stand in solidarity with one another. So we had a lot of very good response from people. We had speakers, and we talked about what the women of RAWA do, and there were many people there who were personally inspired by RAWA. There were several people who weren't political activists, but who had simply seen a RAWA member speak and who were there because they wanted to stand in solidarity with the women of RAWA.
You know, I've seen a real phenomenon in the media, which is you'll have people describing how their loved ones were lost at the World Trade Center and Pentagon and also RAWA we've seen on TV. But when it comes to the second part about what should be done, if there are anti-war voices among those, you instead turn to the, quote, experts on terrorism, like Henry Kissinger, maybe, you know, because it takes one to know one. But you don't hear those same people talking about their views on war, Sonali.
Yes. And I think that's a real tragedy because you have a lot of women in this country who are absolutely supportive of RAWA and are horrified by what was going on and amazed by what these women do, but at the same time are very much wedded to the establishment and couldn't conceive of the fact that their government actively engaged in creating the situation that women of RAWA fight against every day. I mean, fundamentalism in Afghanistan has been empowered by billions of U.S. dollars. And that history is often left out. You know, it is not up to the women of RAWA to expose that. It is up to the women of the United States to expose.
Well, on that note, I want to thank you all for being with us. Sonali Kolatkar of the Afghan Women's Mission in California, Gloria Steinem, co-founder of MIS, Ellie Smeal, the new operator of MIS Magazine, a Feminist Majority Foundation, Jen Posner, independent reporter, and Lisa Maya Jervis of Bitch Magazine. That does it for the program. Democracy Now! In Exile is produced by Chris Abrams, Brad Simpson, Miranda Kennedy, with help from Lizzie Ratner, Saganya Mahendra, and Matthew Power. Anthony Sloan is our engineer and music maestro. You can email us at mail@democracynow.org. Look forward to seeing people in San Francisco on Saturday night with Danny Glover at Mission High School. Democracy Now! Is broadcast in exile from the embattled studios of WBAI, the studios of the Band and the Fire, the studios of our listeners. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening. River and the precious king of the people to sing. Babes in the blinking sun sang we sail over home. I got fury in my soul. Fury's gonna take me to the glory goal in my mind. I can't study war no more. Save the people. Save the children. Save the country. Save the
keep the dream of the two young brothers, gonna take that dream and ride that dove. We could build a dream with love, I know. We could build a dream with love, I know. We could build a dream with love, children. We could build a dream with love, oh people. We could build a dream with love, I know. We could build a dream with love. I got fury, I got fury, I got fury, I got fury in my soul. Gonna take me to the glory, gold in my mind, I can't study war no more. Save the people, save the children, save the country. Everybody save the country, save the country, save the country.